For decades, the National Football League didn't just deny that its players were suffering brain damage, it covered up the problem. That's one of the revelations in the new book, League of Denial, by ESPN investigative reporters Steve Fanneru and his brother, Mark Fanneru Wada. The book also says that the NFL disparaged researchers who did discover a link between football and long-term brain injuries. And, as they also detail in a Frontline documentary, the league created its own research arm that cranked out study after study that denied a connection between football and brain injury. Welcome to the MuckReads podcast. My name is Marshall Allen, and I cover healthcare for ProPublica. The MuckReads podcast is a conversation between investigative reporters about a groundbreaking project. Today, I'm talking with the Fanneru brothers about their book and documentary, League of Denial. Gentlemen, welcome to the MuckReads podcast. Maybe we could start by you giving us an overview of some of the revelations in your book. Mark?
I think, you know, broadly, you know, when we went into this, we wanted to trace what did the NFL know and when did it know it about this issue of concussions and the link to long-term brain damage. Broadly, I think what we've discovered is a two-decade sort of denial by the league, if you will, about the science, sort of two-pronged attack. On the one hand, emerging level of science in which you had researchers, independent researchers, connecting or repetitive trauma to long-term brain damage from football, and those very scientists being attacked. And we lay out in very specific detail the various attacks that were made on some of those scientists by the league. And then secondly, you had the league creating its own research arm, and through that research arm, putting out paper after paper in a journal of called Neurosurgery that was edited actually by a team consultant for the New York Giants. And in those papers, they're just basically sending the message that concussions are not a serious issue, that they're not a problem in the league. That's the sort of broad sweep of what we've revealed.
Steve, as I watched the Frontline documentary and as I read the book, I could see a lot of challenges in terms of landing this project as a journalist. But I'm curious what you all would say were your biggest challenges when you were putting this project together and completing it.
I think there were a number of them. First and foremost is that we didn't have any cooperation from the NFL, you know, which was embroiled in a lawsuit involving 4,500 of its former players that were suing the league for concealing the issue, concealing the connection between football and brain damage, which was exactly what we were trying to investigate, which was, you know, what was the NFL's role in the evolution of this science? So that was challenge one. How do you deal with that? I think the other thing was that we were dealing with a story that was taking place on different planes. There was what was happening in the locker rooms and on the playing fields. It was very much a football story. How are the players dealing with this and what was happening to them? And that was a very sort of human sports story. And then there was the science, which was, you know, when you get really into the weeds in it, is quite complex and arcane and was subject to a lot of different theories about what was actually going on here. And so that was another challenge. And then the sort of the challenge that was most interesting to me was, you know, since the NFL is not cooperating, you know, how do you get a flavor of what the NFL is actually doing around this, which ultimately became the heart of our story? And I think that one of the things that I'm most proud of, and I think Mark is most proud of, is that we were able to amass, I think, an unexpectedly large amount of information about what the NFL was doing on this subject, even though they refused to talk to us. You know, we were able to talk to neuroscientists who were interacting with the league. We were able to acquire literally hundreds of emails of people who were interacting with the NFL's doctors. We were able to get inside of meetings where the NFL was interacting with neuroscientists and really get a flavor of sort of what they were doing, I think, in a way that had not been done before.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, was only getting, not having the NFL's cooperation, because we're all, anytime we get a tip from a source and it sounds like it's the most amazing story in the world, and then you go check it out and you're like, well, okay, it's not quite as black and white as that allegation sounded. And so we're always in danger of only getting one side of the story. What were your attempts to reach out to the NFL? I know, I'm sure you must have made many of them. So, Mark, I don't know if you could tell us what was the timeline in terms of letting them know you were doing the project and urging them to comment?
We were actually, we were incredibly transparent. We wanted to be very transparent with them from the beginning. And so we reached out to them very early on in the reporting process, almost at the very start, really. We've been working on this now for almost 2 years. And we just told them exactly what we were doing, that we were writing a book. Ultimately, there was this documentary that emerged out of the book, and we wanted their cooperation. We wanted to make sure that their voice was heard in the story. And so we actually, ultimately, at their invitation, we flew to New York, and we met with 4 or 5 NFL executives and talked to them about what we were doing. And we had a cordial, amicable conversation with them for about an hour, and they said, "We'll get back to you." And we sent them a list of people we wanted to talk to, and ultimately they just said, "Okay, thanks a lot. We're not gonna help you."
How long ago was that you had the meeting?
I would guess that's about, what is that, a year and a half?
It's probably
now?
A year and
early
a half
in
ago.
The
we
yeah,
were,
very,
we were fairly very early, early in the process. You know, it's interesting when we were getting close to being done. Well, I guess when we were done, I remember seeing David Barstow at IRE talking about how he dealt with Walmart on the Mexico investigation. You know, and he described this incredibly elaborate way in which he went about sort of waiting to talk to Walmart. And it really led me to kind of reflect on sort of how we had dealt with the NFL from a reporting standpoint. Frankly, I guess I felt like in the end our situation was different because I think that some of the contours of the story were known going in, but I don't think Mark and I really knew where it was going to lead, that we were going to discover the level of sort of denial and cover-up that was going on.
Did you go back to them once you discovered this and say, "Hey, just FYI, this is, this is what the story is going to say"?
Yeah, we did.
We went back several times. And of course, we were also doing stories for ESPN at the time that were being born out of the book. And so each time we would have a story, we would go to the league and say, "Look, this is what we've got." So for example, early on, we had one of our first stories was about how you had this weird sort of dichotomy where you had two bodies created both essentially by the NFL and overseen by the commissioner, one of which was a research arm effectively minimizing the connections of concussions and long-term brain damage and the relationship between football. And the other was a body that was actually giving monies to former NFL players who doctors were agreeing that football had caused them brain damage. And so we went to the NFL and told them about that. And we, throughout the process, we went to them about we had a story about Junior Seau and the fight for his brain. And, there was a lot of pushback, frankly, from what our bosses were being called and our bosses' bosses were being called. But there was never a sense that they wanted to cooperate and put somebody forward who wanted to talk to us.
So speaking of your bosses, speaking of ESPN, another thing that is very interesting as a journalist thinking about doing this story, and you refer to it as a journalistic minefield in your kind of introduction to the book, because ESPN, your employer, is paying billions of dollars to the NFL for broadcasting rights. And one of the fundamental tenets of excellent journalism is independence. So there's questions about how do you remain independent when you're working for ESPN, which has a contractual relationship with the NFL. Steve, can you talk about that a little bit, the importance of independence, and then how you maintain that during this project?
Sure. I think this is a question that both Mark and I, it was probably the first question we asked when we went to when we were thinking about working for ESPN, is like, how can you, just think about it on its face. It's, incredibly complicated. It's the biggest business partner of ESPN, $15.2 billion contract with the league. And, we're talking about investigating one of the network's biggest products. And so how do you deal with that? And, we are both convinced that, there is a wall between the entertainment side, the sports side of ESPN and the journalism side, which is a wall that exists in other networks. It's not unique to ESPN, although ESPN in and of itself is quite successful at it. But of course, this was something that we were now putting to the test. And I think up until the most recent developments, it had never been an issue. As Mark said, every step of the way, we got pushback from the NFL. I mean, they fought pretty much every story that we did.
What did that pushback look like? How did they fight it?
Well, they would just simply not comment. So we discovered a document. Did you talk about this, Webster's? We discovered the documents showing that they basically had two different policies, one that said football players get brain damage, one that said they didn't, you know, they basically refused to comment.
So the NFL retirement committee actually gave Mike Webster, this former Steelers center, a retirement compensation because of injuries he sustained while playing football, and then yet their scientific arm is denying that there's any link between
exactly. So the NFL is in the middle of a lawsuit in which they're being accused of concealing the fact that football causes brain damage, and we find out that as far back as 1999 they've been giving out millions of dollars for exactly that disability
with other players too. You pointed out
exactly, and there were NFL documents that were in this case. That showed that. And, you know, the league didn't cooperate with that story. When we found out that the NFL had seized control over the scientific research into Junior Seau's brain after he killed himself, you know, the league, as Mark said, they went after that story with a vengeance. I mean, they went to our editors and they went to our editors' editors and they tried to basically say that it was wrong without really providing any information. And so it was interesting because on the one hand, they were constantly telling us we were wrong, but at the same time, they weren't really cooperating and sort of, you know, as you would hope, like, well, show us how we're wrong, right? That was never really happening. And so basically, you know, as we do in the book and as we do in the film, you know, we just let the information speak for itself.
Now, there was this highly publicized breakdown between ESPN and Frontline. Mark, can you talk about what happened there? Because when I watched the documentary, you all are still credited as writers on the project, right? And
Writers and reporters.
You're quoted extensively. ESPN is named.
So it's, you wouldn't have known it had you heard about it in the public. I mean, it's just a weird thing.
What happened with that? What was the original plan, and then how did this thing
change? I mean, the partnership started. It was born out of the book. The idea was Frontline was interested in creating a documentary built off of the reporting we were doing for the book. And at that point, ESPN partnered with Frontline, and we produced over the course of, I think, a 15-month relationship, you know, a number of stories that were, you know, presented dually, basically, both through Frontline and through Outside the Lines at ESPN. And things were going swimmingly, and everybody was celebrating it publicly. And then abruptly, on the eve of the publication of the book and the airing of the film, ESPN decided to opt out of having its brand attached to the film, you know, and then subsequent to that is of course a narrative that emerges of reporting from the Times about a meeting with Commissioner Goodell pressuring ESPN to bail, and then ESPN did bail. So it was the kind of thing that Steve and I have said this throughout, like any journalist would be completely troubled and disappointed by what happened and by the narrative and how it's been described. At the same time, there's this trying to reconcile that with the reality, which is, as you say, when you watch the film, we're reporters and editors on it. We're identified it with ESPN. Peter Keating from ESPN's in the film. There's footage created by ESPN for Outside the Lines that's in the film. As Steve has said throughout, the book and the film are creatures of ESPN. We wouldn't have been able to do it without the full support of ESPN. And since all this has come out, you've got, you know, ESPN running excerpts of the book, running excerpts of the film.
Interviewing
the two of us. So there's clearly a disconnect. And the reality, I think the one saving grace Steve and I continue to talk about is the journalism hasn't changed a bit. It's exactly as it was when we went into it and before the things changed.
Now, there's so much at stake with this whole subject matter. There are billions of dollars in sports entertainment all the way down to families like my own. I have three boys. They don't play football, and I don't want them to play football. But I have family members whose kids play football. I have friends whose kids play football. And the implications of what you're reporting here are really, really troubling on a lot of different levels. It's very layered throughout our society. I mean, so many tens of millions of people are fanatics about football. So what's it like for you, Steve, when you approach a subject like this that really is a sacred cow in the United States, that people really, there are implications of taking this topic seriously. So when you're a reporter and you're approaching a story like that, what's your mindset when you go into something like that?
You know, I have to say, Mark and I, we both love football. I played football in high school, and it was a huge formative experience for me. I have season tickets to the 49ers. So we are fans of the game. We watch it a lot. And but at the same time, I think my view on this as a reporter is like I can hold both thoughts, right? This is an issue. It's a real issue. And I think as has really become clear to us over the course of doing the reporting, It's an issue that is now affecting hundreds of former NFL players who are dealing with the effects of these injuries, and they are devastating. And they are laid out in chapter and verse in the book in excruciating detail in many cases. And I think as journalists, I just want to know more about it. I'm very curious about it. You know, here, it's just a fascinating story on one level. You have America's most popular sport, a sport that we love, that's also now facing this serious health crisis, and one that not only affects the league, but it also affects people like you and people like me who have kids and are trying to make rational decisions about what kind of risk they want their kids to be exposed to. And I think our goal all along has been to chart the trajectory of the issue, to try to figure out, you know, how did we get to this place? And then what kind of information can we provide to people that will help them sort it out for themselves? Super personal decision. You say you wouldn't want your kids to play football. My son, who's now 14, has been making noises about maybe wanting to play football. And I'm not totally sure how I feel about that. But it's a personal decision. I just think, you know, as a journalist, the more information, the better.
Right, right. Mark, you know, and by the way, I'm also a huge football fan. Grew up in Denver, love the Broncos. So I've
good
also
times
got
for
this,
you right now.
Great
yeah.
times for me right now. But so, Mark, when we think about this and people read this material, there's also, you have to be careful to go no further than what the science says in terms of the interpretation of it or how we understand it. So what's kind of the line in terms of when you looked at the science between what is known and then what is maybe there are hints of things or signs of things, but what is still unknown in terms of whether football is really causing brain injuries?
It's a really good question. And one of the things that I think we're most proud of about the book, I hate to speak for Steve, but I'll do it, of course, is that, please do. But to me, some of the most fascinating stuff in the book is the dynamic of these various researchers battling with each other and really debating the science in many ways, both politically and the reality of the science. And so one of the leading researchers at this point on this issue, the leading researcher in the world, is Anne McKee, a woman from Boston University, who, like virtually everybody in this story, is a huge football fan. She's a massive cheesehead. She grew up in Wisconsin and loves the Packers. You know, McKee, to date, there are 54 NFL brains that have been studied posthumously. 52 of those have shown signs of this neurodegenerative disease called CTE. And she believes that the number of people who are going to have this are a shockingly high number. At the same time, there are folks, and we really lay this out in the book, who are questioning the motives of BU, the suggestion that those people's livelihood are tied to this very question of connecting football to brain damage and whether she's really overstating the prevalence.
Well, and I wonder, too, as a journalist, I write about healthcare, I read these studies, and you wonder, they don't do a lot of autopsies. And when they do autopsies, they don't prepare and slice and dye and study these brains in this way. So how many brains out there who were not football players also have signs of CTE? You know, what could be the other causes of it?
To date, there are no, I mean, at least the researchers we've talked to, there's nobody who's shown a case of CTE without there being repetitive trauma involved.
Okay.
And that's the connection. And I do think, you know, save for some NFL doctors, there seems to be a consensus amongst most researchers that CTE is tied to repetitive trauma and that football is the cause in these cases. There's two issues. One is the prevalence question and really how widespread is it? Because they're only seeing a real skewed data set, right? They're only seeing these autopsied folks. And
right.
So the question is, how prevalent is it really? But then there's the question also of what other mitigating factors are there? Are genetics a part of this? Steroid use, some people
sure.
have suggested, could be contributing factors. So I think that's where the nuance comes in around the disease. But I think for the most part, don't you think we're sort of at a place where largely it's been accepted that this is a disease that's been associated with football. Previously, you know, nobody questioned that it was associated with boxers. That's been fully accepted since the 1920s.
Well, and there are other signs of brain damage, like higher rates of dementia, higher rates of depression, that are also signs, even if you don't look at the CTE, right?
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, that became apparent to us is that you had this sort of parallel narrative going on with regard to the league. One was that you had independent neuroscientists who were trying to tackle the issue on a number of different levels. They were doing surveys of former players, the most exhaustive surveys that had been done to date, that were suggesting strongly that there were much higher rates of dementia and Alzheimer's disease and depression among former NFL players, even before the autopsies were done. And these scientists were some of whom who actually had worked for NFL teams were bringing this information to the league. And so you had that going on, and the league in turn basically trying to squash that science and replace it with its own. And then you had this research arm that had been created by the NFL to promulgate its own science. And that science, as a body of work, said very clearly that concussions are not a major issue in the NFL, that it's okay, that theoretically you could get an infinite number of concussions and still be fine and return to play in the same game, and that NFL players are basically superhuman, that they don't get brain damage. And so, you know, you had this sort of dual narrative going on, and that's what we lay out in some detail in the book. And I think it gets to your earlier question, which I agree with Mark. It's the question. It's sort of like, how much nuance, you know, is there around this disease? Because I think, you know, the best journalism is the most nuanced journalism. It surprises you and it tells you life as it really is, right?
But it also creates such a challenge in the storytelling process, you know, because, you know, just when we do these investigative projects all the time, and it's important to make sure that the nuance is clear, and yet it can make the storytelling challenging because then you have to say what we do know and what we don't know.
I mean, I guess maybe it's easier in a book. I don't know. But yeah. I mean, I think the nuance really plays out in a positive mm-hmm. way. I mean, I think it illuminates the reader. And of course, I mean, so much of it is rooted in the people, you know, and being able to tell the stories of those people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
and you know, as you get to know those characters, the nuances of them sort of come out. And I just think that adds to the discussion. One of the beauties of doing a book is having the narrative freedom in terms of space to really develop who you're talking about, these characters. And these researchers are just fascinating people. I mean, that was, you know, this could be a very arcane, science-oriented book driven by documents that is sort of very difficult to read. But I think we've pulled off, you know, through the development of all these different characters, a real nuanced story that also is imminently readable because people are so fascinating.
Yeah, they're very interesting characters kind of across the board. In terms of having such strong opinions on either side, and then as journalists, people are trying to really manipulate the way we tell a story so that we tell it in their favor a lot of times. And we're all susceptible to being taken kind of captive by sources, you know, who get our ear, and we have to guard against that. So I'm wondering, what were your methods for making sure that everything that you presented was as fair as it could be, as accurate as it could be, and not just overemphasizing one
well,
side?
Well, I think one obvious way was to just try to talk to as many people, anybody who would talk to us, who was involved with this, we wanted to talk to. And, you know, in the case of the NFL, if they wouldn't talk to us, to try to talk to as many people who had interacted with the NFL so that we could accurately reflect their views. As Mark said, you know, the NFL, even though this period of denial that went on for two decades is very clear, and in many of it's public, the people who were involved in it, you know, it wasn't a monolithic group. And so there were different people who were involved. So we tell the story of not only these guys, Ira Kasson, the infamous Dr. No, who simply denied that this was ever a problem, that there was evidence that this occurred, or Dr. Pellman, the famous rheumatologist who was appointed by Paul Tagliabue and then ultimately led the denials. You know, there are people like Mark Lovell, who was a Pittsburgh neuropsychologist, who is a leading expert on neuropsychology and using diagnostic testing to diagnose concussions in NFL players. And he starts off as somebody who's at the forerunner of making people aware that this is a serious thing. And then he ends up on the NFL committee and he finds his name on studies that he ultimately fundamentally disagrees with and has to disavow and does disavow to us. And his transition, the conflicts that he's facing, the conflicts that really he frankly cannot reconcile, are very much a part of the book. I really do feel, I agree with Mark, I think it makes the story richer and more real because that's the real world, that it's shaped, these stories are shaped by the complexity in many ways of not only the subject matter, but the personalities who are involved in it.
Well, the other thing too is, you know, Steve alluded to this early on, email's a wonderful thing, you know, right? I mean, you're talking about, you know, how do we balance all these varying stories? And another tool that was really helpful is, you know, a number of people saved their emails and we were able to get a hold of a lot. And so, you know, we're asking people to remember things that had happened a while ago. But when you've got those emails that were happening in real time and exchanging between the various researchers and people involved, you know, those were critical tools to get a part of too, to tell the narrative.
Excellent. Well, thank you both very much for coming in for the podcast. Very interesting.
Thank
you. It was our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
It's great.
That was Steve Fanaru and Mark Fanaru-Wada. For the Muckreads podcast, I'm Marshall Allen. Thank you for listening.